Welcome back yet again to Red Flags Rising. My name is Mike Hunneke. I am the co-chair of Hughes, Hubbard & Reed's Sanctions, Export Controls, and AML Practice Group. With me, as always, is Brent Carlson, a director at Berkeley Research Group. Brent, good to see you.
Thanks, Mike. Good to see you. Glad to be here as always.
So, Brent, we thought we'd mix things up a little bit on this episode. What are we going to do today?
I think we're going to talk about some latest news that we saw about the AI diffusion rule, and then talk a little point-counterpoint on policy issues and export controls compliance issues around that.
Sounds good. And we're not going to pick particular sides, although we will take particular sides in the debate of a few key points. We also will avoid the personal insults and bad language from the original Saturday Night Live Point Counterpoint with Chevy Chase and Jane Curtin.
This is a family show.
So, Brent, we're seeing a lot of news as recently as yesterday. We should note, as always, the date and the time. It is Thursday, May 8th, 2025, right at 1 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. As we previewed in a prior podcast, May 15th was circled on a lot of calendars. That was the day that the Biden administration's framework for AI diffusion was to come into effect. There's been a lot of pushback from industry on that rule. And to be fair, a lot of questions across the policy community about whether the rule could be effectively implemented or not, given what was admittedly some complexity in how it carved up the world into three different tiers. So, Brent, what's the latest news that we've seen?
The Trump administration is probably going to scrap and replace the rule. There's been a lot of debate over the rule. You mentioned complexity. It is a pretty hefty thing when you print the whole thing out, and even when you print on both sides, it can be a nice doorstop. One of the objectives of the America First trade policy in terms of export controls is to make them simpler, stronger, and more effective. That's partly what we're looking at here. What's probably going to go away is that three-tiered country system and be replaced by bilateral deals between the United States and other countries around the world seeking to gain access to cutting-edge AI technology.
The real shame about that is that we will, if that happens, lose the very helpful three-part framework that Bharath Haritas from the Center for Strategic International Studies came up with that you and I talked through on our last pod, where he had broken down the three tiers into first class, maybe premier, business class, and then coach. Be careful what you wish for, right? You know, the articles are careful to note that this doesn't mean everyone's going to first class, to borrow that metaphor. We might all find ourselves in economy, or even worse, on standby. Now, it also does appear from what we've seen in the news that there will be many opportunities for people to purchase upgrades, but likely at great expense.
I like the analogy of standby. If I was going to guess where things are going to go, that's probably where it's going to head. It's going to be standby until you make a deal with the United States on these issues. And they're going to be probably wrapped up in other trade issues as well. No matter how it's going to shake out at the end and what's going to replace the Biden administration's AI diffusion rule, the national security issues around all this still remain.
Absolutely. As we said last time, don't think for a second that there aren't going to be the physical cyber and export controls around the delivery and operation of these data centers that we did see in the framework for AI diffusion.
What we talked about on our last podcast episode are those national security issues that were cited in the AI diffusion rule. And this cuts right to WMD, weapons of mass destruction, their design, their development, and also the diffusion around the world of these capabilities also lowers the barriers to entry for others. This could be used by bad actors, terrorist actors, if they get access to it. And that's why no matter what's going to happen in terms of how the exact rule is going to be remade and replaced, these national security issues still remain and will still need to be addressed in whatever deals get cut at the end of the day.
So, Brent, I think that's a good segue to our new segment, Point Counterpoint. We find that in talking to a lot of people, there's a huge disparity in viewpoints, and it's not necessarily even a smooth curve of different viewpoints. It's usually one extreme or the other. I think it would be useful, hopefully interesting, and maybe even ideally helpful to our listeners on both sides of these various debates to take the moment and try to take each position, explain it, and then maybe at the end of the pod, try to offer some paths forward where people can either both be unhappy or hopefully both find their main concerns addressed.
At the end of the day, there's a constructive path that we think can be found. I'll just kick it off here with some people saying that export controls have failed in stemming China's ambitions for AI development. Why bother with them at all? Why should we put any controls on this at all?
Yeah, Brent, we hear this a lot with really any kind of regulation that is deemed to be burdensome. that requires time and effort to get right, that if you don't see the outcomes you are desiring by imposing this burden on people, then we should get rid of them because they do impose costs. They do restrict markets. They do restrict sales. If we think we benefit from, even from a national security perspective, by being the leader in the business of designing and manufacturing semiconductors, for example, any control that restricts that and restricts access to markets is a bad control. A lot of times you hear people say, well, this is just going to prompt other people in other countries that are adversarial to us, or that we think are adversarial to us, to develop their own homegrown alternative. And then we will be worse off because we will have no control over the technology, its use, and its design if someone else is doing something equal or, with increasing concern, even better than we are. You know, I think this really comes back also to a point that Gregory Allen of the CSIS has talked about, where if they really aren't working, then we are in the worst possible policy situation because we've chosen to enact a very high wall, very strict regulations. This is imposing costs, and not only in compliance, but also in the terms of denying market opportunities to our companies. And if they aren't effective to begin with, if, say, China can, through smuggling, other activities, or frankly, even design flaws in the export controls, get essentially what it needs, even through the creation of brute force networks where they don't care about the amount of power consumed, then what are we doing? Brent, what's the counterpoint to that?
Another perspective, when we talk about national security issues, these are fundamental safety issues. In every country around the world, to drive an automobile, one needs to be of a certain age and to have a license to drive. You wouldn't just hand over your sports car to your five-year-old and let your five-year-old just drive around town in your sports car. That's a recipe for disaster. And I think that's what we're looking at here with artificial intelligence technologies as well. Another issue that I'd like to just kind of point out too, there's been debate over, okay, well, talking about China and putting export controls on China, specifically in this AI space, there's some arguments saying, well, that just spurred China on in its own development. Actually, I'd say from the very beginning of China's modern development track, the whole goal has been to develop and displace foreign technologies. Just look at the experience of the automobile industry, going way back to the Beijing Jeep, for those of you who know what that is out there, all the way to the situation of the automobile industry in China today. That's basically that trajectory. For China, or any country for that matter, they're going to want to set their industrial policies so they can be strong in the areas they want to play. That's completely natural. But understand that the objective from the beginning is to grow domestically and develop domestically these key technologies. We've come now on the 10-year mark of China's Made in 2025 plan. We're going to see a continuation of that down the road.
Some people take very seriously the stated national security justifications for these regulations. If you read any of these regulations, there is a preamble from the Department of Commerce where they talk about the assessment of the U.S. intelligence community about how are these chips being used or how could they be used to threaten American national security and the safety of Americans, and as well as our friends and allies around the world. There are other people who might view that more as an offered legal justification for why these rules are being enacted, but are maybe behaving in ways that they don't see the clear and present danger that others might see about what they're doing. You could take very different views about this. The problem that exists, Brent, in taking the view that these national security justifications are unfounded or are being overblown is that private actors have very limited ability to challenge these. But we also, I don't think, appreciate how they are developed and the huge amount of data and analysis that goes behind them. We'll have an upcoming episode of the podcast with a guest speaker to get into that a little bit more. I'm excited about that. But what's your take on that issue, Brent?
Actions speak louder than words. And you can see where the U.S. government, China, other countries around the world are looking at AI as a major displacer, not only for commercial activities, but also the military applications of the future. We're entering a new era. You can see this also where this has been showing up on the battlefields in different hotspots around the world, like Ukraine. And we do know that the major militaries in the world have been incorporating AI into weapon systems and developing those as well.
You know, Brent, the lesson of Ukraine has been these things are dissected all the time, not only by intelligence operatives or military operatives, but by NGOs, by people who go to the press, who present their findings to the United States Congress and the European Union, for example. It creates this political and media and reputational maelstrom that becomes very difficult to navigate, especially if you're taking the position, well, look, we did what we needed to do, and that's going to fall flat when clearly something bad happened. I hope that the middle road here is not just this outright total rejection of the national security justifications for these rules. The risk is real. If you listen to Dario Amodei talk about this, for example, and Anthropic's particular perspective on these risks, he's very careful to say, look, I know if I cry wolf that there are downsides to that. And he's very careful not to do that. But if he doesn't say anything, then his company, people who think like him, won't be able to push the trend to an upward trend of good behavior, of morality, of compliance. They won't be able to fight against that inevitable and, frankly, very natural trend of racing to the bottom. So he's trying to create this ecosystem where there are good incentives, and whether there are good actors or bad actors, that they're being pushed in the right direction. That to me is a very sophisticated way to think about it and is hugely parallel to what you and I both saw in multiple decades of dealing with anti-corruption enforcement. Did everyone always do the right thing? No. Did everyone have perfect information? Never. But when enforcement and policy were aligned and people felt there was a real risk, that pushed the curve in a certain direction. And you could at least see trends over time of companies becoming more compliant, less open to some of the old tricks or the obvious red flags that maybe 30 years ago would have been a tax deduction. There was a change in mindset and a change of behavior by taking that approach. So I hope that's where we end up here.
Going back to the old days of corruption when there used to be tax deductions in many jurisdictions around the world, I think what happened is that over time you saw that there's a real cost for that, and there's a cost to business for doing that. I mean, going back in the day when I was doing business development around the world, you couldn't.
Brent, I'm telling you as your lawyer, stop talking.
Well, no, I'm just saying, hey, I'm just saying, look at it. You cannot build a sustainable business on corruption, right? So you have to look at what's going to be a sustainable business. And that's based upon your product, your technology, your service. That's when you think about what's going to be sustainable here. This helps us get to the middle road in terms of how we're going to deal with artificial intelligence technologies and how these can be shared and diffused around the world in the right way. Any technology going back to the beginning of humanity can be used for good or bad. It comes down to fundamentally a human response in terms of how we use the technologies. And we have to really think about how we're going to use these technologies and make sure that we have the right approaches in place. It's a safety issue. When we say national security, this is a safety issue. This is the safety of the people of the United States of America and people around the world. So I think it's important to think of it from that perspective. We can get to a middle ground here in terms of no export controls at all on this stuff versus a complete ban on this stuff, and everybody hunkers into their own fortresses and doesn't share information. I mean, really, the future of humanity is a shared one, and it's better to be connected and have these technologies available to advance humanity. But we can't be naive about this as well and just expect that it's just going to turn out without any realistic approach in place to make sure that bad actors do not get access to this.
Brent, the other kind of counterpoint to the viewpoint that maybe these issues are overblown is that these are the government's views and they're bipartisan views. Just look at some of the letters coming out of the House Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. Look at some of the letters that Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Josh Hawley have signed together. People are getting information that's causing there to be a security consensus, at least on Capitol Hill, on these issues. So whether that's right or not, almost doesn't matter. If you're a company dealing in this space, it's going to continue to be regulated. If you don't acknowledge the government's perspective that these are serious security issues, you're going to start off on the wrong foot with a lot of people. And that's not a place to be. We don't believe for a second that there are any people in U.S. design companies, in U.S. manufacturing companies that are hoping for the harmful and deadly, in some cases, outcomes that we've unfortunately seen. So, Brent, taking a step away from the broader national security policy objectives, let's talk about export control effectiveness. There are a lot of different criteria that people have pointed to argue why U.S. export controls, especially as to semiconductors, supercomputers, quantum AI are effective or not effective. Brent, what's one argument that people raise for why the export controls are not effective?
First of all, it comes down to the definition. What is effective in terms of export controls?
There are some people who take the position that if we have evidence that, say, for example, DeepSeek was able to make surprising advances, either because they could somehow readily obtain chips that they should not have been able to obtain, or simply because they are able to do more with less, with things that they legitimately obtain, then we should just give up. Well, this isn't all or nothing. That doesn't determine whether we do this or not. An analogy that comes to my mind is murder. Just because people are murdered doesn't mean we should get rid of the laws prohibiting murder. For some people, laws and regulations will shape conduct. So if there is a national security basis for controls, even 5% efficacy is still better than zero. The fact that somebody smuggled chips or even a large number of chips got through doesn't necessarily mean that they aren't having a long-term effect on, in this case, China's advancements. If you look at some of the work by Dario Amodei, specifically his essay about DeepSeek and export controls, this is the point he makes. Greg Allen at CSIS makes these points very frequently as well. The standard is not they got somewhere, so that's bad. The standard is where would they have gotten if there had been no controls or no limitations on how they got there?
You make a very good point in terms of affecting conduct. Because if you look at export controls that the U.S. has put in place over the last couple of years, what has that resulted in? Well, on the China side, it has its anti-foreign sanctions laws. If they're completely ineffective, why would a country like China have to put in a law that would prohibit its citizens from implementing U.S. export controls? The other issue is smuggling. If U.S. export controls are totally ineffective, why the necessity for a big smuggling network? Even showing up on videos on the internet bragging how they brought these into the country. If it wasn't working, why would you need that at all? That's an indication that export controls do work. The issue is, how can they work better? We talked about there's the two elements of design and enforcement. By design, you're going to have a certain percentage of people for any law, any regulation, you're going to have a certain percentage of people that are and companies that will comply. They'll do it. The second part is really enforcement. And I think this has been an area for improvement. There's been questions by industry and advisors to industry in terms of, well, you've seen signals for enforcement, but you haven't seen follow-up in terms of cases. It takes cases. It takes cases with substantial fines, not just a parking or speeding ticket. Any regulation without enforcement is a paper tiger and will be viewed as such. It will be ridiculed and mocked by bad actors who just work around it. But the tools are there to shut those bad actors down.
And on the design front, going back to that point, we're seeing that debate play out in front of us in real time. Grant, several news outlets reported that the Trump administration was going to get rid of the rule. If you look at the April 3rd executive summary of the reports that Chair of Commerce delivered to the president on the topic of export controls and loopholes that people are exploiting in export controls, that section of the executive summary says we're going to make these rules simpler, stronger, and more effective. So it doesn't mean it's going away. Going back to the airplane tickets analogy, everyone might be on the wait list. And yes, you can maybe upgrade to first class, but that's going to be a negotiation. What I did see in some of the reporting that maybe got a little undernosed and certainly wasn't part of the headlines was that the administration, the spokesperson for BIS actually said, and in the meantime, we're going to continue to enforce the rules. So it's not this sudden kind of, the gates are open, sell them while you got them type of moment. It may end up being like we've seen in other regulatory contexts, careful what you wish for. You want to reopen something, you want to change something. Well, when you do that, you may not be able to control who's changing it and for what purpose. So we may see that there may be some unintended consequences in the efforts to reopen this rule. So design playing out in front of us. Implementation, is it effective? Not only is there enforcement by the government, but is there compliance by exporters? Is there compliance by resellers? Is there compliance by distributors? Enforcement by the government creates the value proposition for investments and compliance by any of those actors. Guidance from the government helps those actors, again, exporters, resellers, distributors, manufacturers. It helps those people to gauge and target the deployment of resources to what might be the greatest risks. National security issues should inform how comfortable you are getting close to the edge. You know, there's often an allusion made to the speed limit. If the speed limit's 65, it's not illegal to go 64, right? The question is, are we on the safe road? Are your tires inflated properly? Are you heading in the right direction? The road may be closed ahead, or maybe you're on an unauthorized road or off-piste, as the skiers who might be listening might say. Then it doesn't really matter what your speed is.
You make some very good points here, Mike, in terms of what could trigger enforcement and what could trigger potential violations of U.S. export controls. And that speed limit analogy is very good because it talks about what are the technical parameters, what are the technical thresholds. Everybody focuses on the technical thresholds, but you and I have talked for a very long time on end use and end user, and especially how the full definition of knowledge under the Export Administration Regulations also includes an awareness of a high probability. What we've seen is that the government has these tools in place. We've seen this full definition of knowledge used in other contexts by the U.S. government, where you had a small U.S. government staff of just a few dozen people raising $30 billion in fines with over 700 investigations over a 20-year period. When we're looking at government agencies now that are facing budget cuts, but they still have to fulfill their missions as directed by the president, enforcement is a way where it can close some of these budget gaps and fulfill its mission. The tools, especially for U.S. export controls, are already there through that high probability standard. It's just having the will to do it.
Right, and where there's a will, there's a way.
If we don't reach a middle path, then we're looking at veering from one extreme to another, which creates even more frustration for everybody, either industry or government. And that's where we get this middle road in terms of coming together and having communication. Instead of trying to try to all have all or nothing, let's get to that middle part where both sides can leverage that full definition of knowledge under the Export Administration Regulations. From the government's perspective, it can protect the national security and the people of the United States. And from industry, continue to be global players and continue to innovate, and for American technology to be the leader and the standard throughout the world. There is a path forward here where we can work it out, where it's a win-win for everybody in these new geopolitical conditions.
And that's exactly what we talked about in the last episode, right? That we have a path forward. We have this idea. I think it's been helpful, frankly, to me to go through this exercise of looking at the different perspectives on the issues. I'm even more convinced now that this path exists, that government and industry can walk it together. The middle path is a workable way through this. If people don't see eye to eye, then you have this hardening of a view that the regulations are nonsensical and can't be followed anyway. And guess what? Then they won't be.
That's right.
Well, Brent, that brings us again by rising popular demand to your segment, Managing Up. Brent, what is your managing up advice for this episode?
Simple is indeed better. We live in a world of increasing complexity, and whenever something is complex, things can break down. Warren Buffett just recently retired, and Warren Buffett was known for his investing philosophy. If he looked at a potential deal and it was just too complex where he could not understand it, he would pass on it. Simplicity is the essence of efficacy.
Thanks a lot, Brent. That's a very simple but very effective managing up for the week to close in the spirit of point counterpoint, with the idea that it's important to not assign to people you're arguing against, your regulators, your competitors, bad will or bad intentions. Maybe it's just a little bit of Ohio in me, but I think it's helpful to go through the world thinking that most people are just trying to get through their day. They're trying to do their jobs. They're trying to take care of their families. They're not trying to nefariously engage in world-altering national security threats or anything like that. That doesn't mean those threats aren't real or that they're not out there, but finding that common ground, taking the time to hear out what the other side is saying, and then collaboratively speaking together to find a solution, a middle road, is a very valuable trait and a bit of a lost art, but one that we can all still aspire to. I think our country would be in an amazing place if we are able to feel safe and secure in the technology that we're shipping to others, while also rewarding and further encouraging really entrepreneurial spirits to innovate and to go sell and to go export to the world. Maybe a bit optimistic, but hopefully we follow the path that gets us there. That concludes this episode of Red Flags Rising. Looking forward to the next one. Please give us reviews. Please rate us in your app. If you have any feedback, let us know. You can find in the show notes everything you need in order to contact us. as we've said before, we're always happy to have a virtual coffee or a real one. Just let us know. Brent, be well.
Thanks, Mike. Be well.